Views on this program are opinions of dental industry experts and not necessarily those of dentist advisors. Opinions shared in the following interview do not constitute personal financial advice. This program is furnished by Dentist Advisors, a registered investment advisor.
This is Dentist Money. Now, here's your host, Reese Harper.
Welcome to the Dentist Money Show, where we help dentists make smart financial decisions. I'm your host, Reese Harper, live on set at Yankee Dental Congress 2017 with a special guest. We had to tempt him with all kinds of treats to get him over here. He doesn't do a lot of interviews. Mr. Mark Rosen.
Thanks, Reese, for having me on here. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, man, I'm excited because there's probably not too many people I can legitimately say across the country that will have experience coming from hundreds of dental practices, as many as you guys have, north of 800, if I'm not mistaken. So that's a big group, a big sample size of a lot of experiences, a lot of data. It runs in the family.
Okay? It does.
So dad's got experience going back to the 70s?
Yeah, 78. Right? We started with about 10 dentists and then sort of grown it over the years. And about 10 years ago, I had about 300, 350 and then started to explode as
it's crazy.
Things have changed. The tax structure and the economy has just changed and people have really been seeking the advice, which is great.
That's awesome. I mean, it's a pretty big accomplishment to stay within a market and grow and stay committed to that market. And I just congrats for all the hard work you guys have put in. I think it's a really big achievement. So
no, appreciate it. The niche markets, it's great. I think, you know, orthodontist focus and oral surgeons focus, and to have team of professionals that just focus on what they do, it's great. It's really good business.
Let's talk a little bit about your personal background, how you got into deciding to follow in the footsteps of maybe family. And did you always know you're going to go into accounting? Did you always know you're going to have some finance kind of career, or were you thinking about maybe being a music major?
Music, no, definitely not. my bar mitzvah ended that, I think. But what happened, pretty much went to University of Vermont, accounting major. Kind of knew I wanted the numbers side of things.
Cool.
Came out of school, worked for a big four firm that's no longer around, unfortunately. And then went over to my father's side back in 1999 and started to work with dentists then and worked with a lot of the young dentists starting from scratch. My father obviously had a lot of the more veteran practices, if you will.
Yeah.
And now begin to transition and work with the younger guys has been great.
Yeah,
you know, kind of hit everything with them.
That's awesome. So how does the practice look today? I mean, it's you and your dad. You guys got a big team. You have a lot of services. Just give people some context of the breadth of and scope of what you guys cover.
Sure. So there are five partners in Rosen Associates, including my father and myself. Have a staff of about 35, including some administrative staff, bookkeepers, tax managers, and which help cover all the clients and all their needs. We also have an affiliated practice that transitions dental practices called More Dental Solutions. We do transitions and valuations. All the partners in Rosen are also a partner in More, along with John Lederick and the managing partner, Maria Malone, who's a certified valuation analyst. So helps value practices and helps transition them. Then we have a retirement planning group, helps design and implement 401k plans. And then a wealth management company that manages about $1.2 billion under management. Some CFPs in that group, about 20 people in that group. So education planning, retirement planning, kind of strategic planning. And so we work hand in hand with all of them, make sure every kind of T is crossed and I is dotted, and really works out pretty well. Kind of one-stop shop for those that want it.
Yeah, that's great. So let's talk a little bit about some of the kind of main areas that I think you could really add some insight into. Talk to me a little bit about what are some of the, if you just took a high level view and you were taking a stab at making some broad comments about things that dentists struggle with.
Sure.
What kind of advice would you give around things that dentists struggle with? What are problems that you really say, look, before I meet someone, these are kind of the things that I've seen and expect to bump into?
Yeah, so it's a great question. The in school, great clinical training, they get a lot of stuff like that. What they lack, obviously, is the business side of things. And so you come out of school and immediately, once you own a practice, you're thrown into being a CFO, a CEO, and everything. So where the struggle comes in is how do you transition from being that clinician to the practice owner, to be a CEO? So you got to lean on the advisors. And when you look at owners and CEOs of big corporations, they have lots of advisors. And so I think they struggle with reaching out early in the process to make sure you get that foundation squared away for the practice and making sure, you know, the hiring's done right, when to bring in people. And then probably the most important thing will drive everything is the numbers.
Yeah.
Right? We want to know where do they boil down to. So getting that team together, put the numbers together, And it's great. We can put numbers together all day long. But if they don't look and they don't understand what they're reading, what's the point? Yeah. Right? So junk in, junk out. They've got bad numbers. You're going to have bad information and bad metrics to go by. Yeah. So that's definitely where a struggle comes in.
Do you like to see, what if somebody says, you know, I want to do my own bookkeeping. I like to do my own bookkeeping and to get into my own numbers. I'm sure you guys have clients that have said that, or clients you do bookkeeping for, some maybe you don't. I mean, what's your perspective on a dentist doing his own bookkeeping?
Yeah, I think early on, I highly encourage everyone to do their own bookkeeping. I want them to, because they should know what's going in and out of the practice. You know, you step into a practice, you, let's say purchase, and there's an office manager there, and that person's been doing the books for years. You don't really have a good grasp of what they're doing. But if you get in there, you pay the bills, even if it's for a couple months, just see what goes in and out of the practice. I want you to do it. However, you know, if you're spending time doing that and not being in the chair because the chair's busy and you don't have time, then we got a problem. You're worth more in the chair than you are sitting down doing a bank reconciliation or paying bills. So there's that fine line between when do you make the switch of, hey, I'm getting to know my practice really well and I'm getting to know the ins and outs, to I'm going to make more money in the chair. So that I'm going to stop doing this, hand it over to us, or hand it over to a bookkeeper in-house and go from there.
What should a dentist be aware of? Even if someone's doing his books, what are some things that he should be aware of in his numbers? What are things you encourage people to be on top of, or things that you might be on top of yourself as the advisor to the dentist as it relates to his financials?
Yeah, well, cash is king, right? I mean, we need the cash. I don't mean literal cash, literally cash, but, you know, the money coming in the bank is king. So managing that is extremely important, both the ins and the outs. From a personal standpoint, meaning we're stripping the practice of cash because we're living a lifestyle we shouldn't be, or we're, you know, going to accumulate cash in the practice and know what's there. So if we need to go out and purchase a piece of equipment, we don't have to borrow the money. So I want the practices to, yes, look at cash, very important. Then let's start looking at expenses. I mean, staff is your number one expense, right? That's 25 to 27% of any practice. So by far your largest expense. Got to make sure that that's under control. Once that goes astray, tough to reel it in, right? Tough to fire Susie, who's been there for 30 years and now wants a $5 raise. So got to keep an eye on that. So our goal quarterly, really, you know, put together financial statements, compare those numbers to industry averages and make sure they're in line. They're keeping an eye on that. We've got the right amount of staff to do the right amount of production needed. You know, run it as slim as you can run it, right? Because the rest of it's going to fall straight to the bottom line.
Yeah.
So keep an eye on that. It's big time important. But again, you know, all boils back to the cash we got in the bank. We can't pay anything or anybody if we don't have cash.
So how much liquidity would you recommend that somebody keep in their practice, you know, relative to maybe the overhead they have? Or what does that look like? What advice would you give to say, how much do I need to keep in my practice before I can start taking distributions and kind of remove the excess cash?
Yeah, I'd love to see, when I get practices starting out, I mean, those practices start either from scratch or just buy them. My goal is take as little as you need to out of the practice. I want to see, probably it's called a $1 million practice. I'd love to see $100,000 in the bank, you know, pretty safe. You got 75, okay, dips down to 50 for a couple weeks and back up, fine.
Yeah.
Be able to cover the months of payroll, maybe 2 months of payroll is good. There's no hard and fast line to it, but it also is going to depend on what does the practice do on a month-to-month basis, and what, you know, do I see the practice in a time period of buying, so we're going to keep more in there?
Yeah.
Or is it a slow time where, you know, during the summertime we take more vacation, so let's build up the account going into the summer because we know it's just going to dip down and use money then. So definitely keep liquidity, because the other side of that too, which is extremely important, is when they go to borrow money, the banks want to see liquidity,
totally.
Right? And that's where people lose it. Hey, my numbers are great. I'm netting 50% and this, that, and the other thing, but I've got 10 grand in the bank. I'm looking to borrow a 500 to do a build out. And now the bank is thinking they're lending you money to live on, and then they got a problem.
Yeah. Tell me when a new dentist gets started and comes and talks to you and says, you know, I want to pay off all of my student loans first, though. I'm kind of worried about that. And sometimes that comes at the expense of them building liquidity in the practice. They're so worried about those student loans and those payments. How do you try to coach people through understanding debt and how it works and how you should use it?
Student debt's great debt to have. It really is. It doesn't prevent you from getting a practice. Doesn't prevent you from buying a home. You can't deduct it. I hope you can't deduct it, meaning you're making enough money that you're not getting that deduction.
Yeah.
But I would say let that ride. You let it ride, because as you go further and further in the practice, you will earn more money. And maybe down the road, we can throw a little extra money. Early on, borrowing money nowadays, cheap.
Yeah.
You know, and with, there are some companies out there that can refinance student debt into a cheap number, under 5%, 4%, in which case, even wrap it into the practice down the road. You know, where now we're getting a full deduction out of it because we've now taken a loan that was outside the practice, taking essentially a working capital loan in the practice. Now we're deducting the interest, getting a little benefit from it, just paying it down slowly but surely. So
yeah.
I wouldn't suggest paying it down early on. It's a big number, obviously, intimidating to most. And so letting that ride for a while, building the liquidity up, investing in the practice, because you invest early in the practice, it will pay tenfold down the road where we can throw big chunks at it once we've got a plenty of cash flow to deal with.
Yeah, it's good insight. Tell me a little bit about just your general debt philosophy. Let's talk about practice debt in general. When should someone start reducing that, or how do you usually like to try to structure their amortization schedules, you know, so that people aren't cash cramped and they do have some liquidity? Is there any guidelines that you'd like to kind of talk to people about that?
So let's take in two steps. Step number one, let's say buying a practice. You buy a practice and you're going to take on a big loan. Most of those, I would love to see a 7-year amortization. Great. The banks will give you 10 to 15 years to pay it, and that's okay. I'm okay with this. You know, pay smaller, build up cash flow, you know, as you go into a new practice, but know that it works at a 7-year amortization. I don't love 15. If you need 15 years to pay off a practice, the practice isn't worth it. It's too long. You're going to spend too much money in doing it. But the ability to borrow right now is pretty easy, even in this market. So you can get 4% or under. So leverage the money, borrow it. Don't necessarily pay it down early. You know, I want to see the practice go along for a couple years and see what the cash flow looks like.
Yeah.
On the flip side, when you're building a practice, I mean, you have no cash flow.
Yeah.
So stretch that thing out 10 years also. You could go 15 just to ease the cash flow. But again, I'm going to try to force you to get it done in 10 or refinance it along the way so it does get done in 10.
So you'd feel comfortable with someone having a longer amortization schedule early on just until they get their cash flow organized and once they invest properly in the practice, build that liquidity, then just accelerate the payment on that or refinance it to a shorter term.
Yeah, it goes back to that comment of cash is king.
Yeah.
I mean, you really keep that cash on hand, and if I can borrow it at 4%, and build my bank account up. Sure, if I've got $300,000-$400,000 in the bank, all right, let's pay down the $100,000 loan that's hanging out there, a little bit at a time.
Yeah.
But for the most part, build up the cash, because the last thing I like to see is, hey, Mark, looking at a soft tissue laser, $7,000. I think I got to borrow for it.
Yeah, classy.
That's no good, right? No good. So, yeah. Or I'm gonna put on a credit card and then transfer it to a 0%.
Totally.
No, we don't want that.
Yeah.
We want that to be paid in cash, no problem.
So. Let's talk about early on. We're still kind of in this early on career phase. We'll kind of move through different phases of the career.
Sure.
What do you think it makes sense for people to do when you say start saving money and build an emergency fund personally, maybe getting a little bit away for retirement to start reducing your taxes? Is there an amount of money, maybe a percentage of income that you like to see people save, or a range of what they should be targeting before they start throwing everything extra towards debt?
You go by the financial planning books, it's going to tell you 6 months. Good luck getting 6 months of income saved up. Very difficult. But like I said in a seminar the other day, it's harder, you know, and even personally, you could probably speak to it, it's harder to put money away than to pull it back. It's hard to pull it back when you send it out. So I like a monthly savings. Set it up, $100 a month, get sent over to an account, because it's going to be harder to bring that back. You know, if I told you, hey, put away $5,000 and put it into an account, I can't do it. But if I said, give me $20 a week, you could probably give up $20 a week. Easier in drips and drabs there.
Yeah.
So I like long-term, you know, spread it out. You know, especially the younger kids nowadays, they don't have the large cash positions to be able to throw chunks at things. So that savings has to take place over a longer period of time. So set up a savings account with an automatic withdrawal that just, boom, comes out. You learn to live without it and build that up. I mean, if you can have two months, 3 months worth of savings, in your back pocket for a rainy day, if you're in between associate jobs or you're looking to build a practice, you're going to need a little bit of a kitty in order to help build that up. Not to use the money from a loan standpoint, but just to help live on and not necessarily have to work so much in the associate job to fund it.
Great. Let's say I'm like 5 years in, I'm 7 years in, I'm cranking, I've got my loans, I've got my practice furnished properly, I've got the right equipment, I'm earning my peak income that I'm probably going to be at, you know, or roughly there. Then what should I be saving? You know, how should I be looking at how much to put away versus to paying down my debt. Let's say I'm at my kind of my close to my peak earnings.
Well, let's hope that's not your peak. Yeah, keep going.
Let's say my peak will keep growing slowly point.
No, I mean, once you're 2-3 years in, maybe hitting five, we're definitely looking inside the practice for larger retirement, let's just say retirement savings. Yeah. So early on, little money. If you want to put something away, you're looking at an IRA, you know, $5,500, but hopefully not a Roth. Hopefully you're making more money than that in order to put money in there. Once we get into the practice, now we're talking, you know, retirement plans, 401ks, simple plans, and even different types of plans.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the retirement plan options that people have at that phase of their career. I think it'd be interesting to get your insight because I know you guys do a lot of that work for clients as well. When do I set up a simple IRA versus maybe do a 401k?
Yeah.
How do I make that decision?
I like simples to an extent. I mean, the maximum you're going to be able to get in there is a much lower level. You know, it's around $12,500. I think that maximum you can get in 2017, I believe. I'm not positive, but close.
Yeah.
There's no fees associated with getting that simple set up. So in the first couple of years, if you think you can get more than an IRA amount, more than $5,500, but not quite up to that $18,000 if you're under 50 years old, into a 401k, simple is the way to go.
Mm-hmm.
The trick with a simple, though, is as soon as you start it in a year, you got to finish it with the year. You can't have a simple and a 401k. So a young, growing practice, couple years in, a simple is a nice way to start. But if you know that you're going to go into a 401k, that's where you want to get to. It's nice to just start with it right off the bat.
Yeah, makes sense.
There's a fee to set it up, obviously, because there's record keeping. There's a $5,500 tax return that gets filed every year in order to make sure you're compliant with everything. But once you get that, we'll take someone under 50 years old here, get that $18,000 deferred in off your payroll. Now you're talking one piece of the pie. Your next piece is a match payment, safe harbor match, 3%, a 3% safe harbor or a 4% match on top of the 18. And then that third piece is a profit sharing contribution. That's how you're going to get up to, I think, $54,000 in there. A lot of cash, no doubt about it. So we need the cash flow. We look at the tax deduction comes along with it and how much you got to give the staff.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, everyone wants to treat their staff well, biggest asset you have. And so how much do we need to give the staff in order to get me, the doctor, $54,000 or to max out? And how much am I going to save from the government? Most people, pretty much 10 out of 10 times, say, if I can give the staff money and not give it to the IRS, I'm going to do that for the benefit of the staff, morale, so on and so forth.
Yeah.
Now, there's another piece. When you're, not to jump too far ahead there, you're 10 years into a practice or your income is really great and far above the employees, if you will. Now we start looking at like a cash balance plan. You know, cash balance plan's a hybrid plan between a defined benefit plan, those old pension plans back in the day, and a defined contribution, which is a 401k plan.
Yeah.
Now you can get 150 grand into a plan, 200 grand into a plan. You need the steady cash flow to do it. Huge, huge savings opportunities, big times tax savings, and to load into a retirement plan that maybe you fell behind early in the years because you wanted to focus on student loans.
Yeah.
And the practice is doing well enough. I see it a lot with specialists. Yeah. You know, you got an oral surgeon, no hygiene, obviously, in the practice. So there's a big discrepancy between the doctor and the, quote, rank and file employees who are making 50, 60. Doctors making 300, 400, 500, although you're only using 270 as the cap to look at from the calculation standpoint. Big discrepancy. Doctor can get a lot of money in. It's best to have about a 10-year gap between older doctor, younger staff. That's how retirement plans work best because that older doctor is closer to retirement.
Yeah.
So it works out well.
That's great. It seems like there's just a graduated scale of retirement plans to set up as I start earning more and have the ability to defer more. And tell me when someone says, maybe I should convert some of my traditional IRA money or maybe I'll do a Roth 401k or I'll do a Roth IRA conversion. How do you feel about those things and how does that usually work out from a tax perspective?
Yeah, good question. If they're done early enough, meaning when you convert that traditional, you're going to pay tax on it, right? So if we can do it, if you're smart enough to do it early on, and let's say in your practice, when your income's low, we're not going to pay much tax, right? Now we're going to let it grow tax-free and never have to take the money out in a Roth IRA. So Roth IRAs have great aspects to them, you know, from an estate planning standpoint. I mean, a Roth, to be honest, if you can start a Roth and never need that money, I mean, that thing's going to grow forever and then flip to the kids, and now they're taking it over their lifetime. So it's really growing for like two lifetimes.
Yeah.
But if you early on, in, you know, before you could do the conversions, if you set up a lot of traditional IRAs, now and you're in a high tax bracket, is it worth paying the tax at 40% or more when, you know what, I'll hang on to it. I'll retire 70 and a half. I'm not working. I'm not in the 40% bracket anymore. I'll pay the tax at whatever bracket it is then.
Yeah.
So you definitely got to look at situation by situation. But it's...
It can make sense if you do it early enough and you convert it when your tax rate's low.
And hopefully you never need Roth money.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't need that money and you let it keep going, that's good stuff.
Totally. Let's talk a little bit about when I know... Let's talk a little bit about entrepreneurship and strategic stuff. If I'm... How do I know if I'm a dentist that probably should open a second location and keep growing and expanding versus... maybe just stick with my focus on being a clinician and making one practice just hum and be super profitable. It seems like there's a lot of dentists that get lost in that journey, right? Comparing themselves to others and feeling like they might not be doing enough. And sometimes it can create problems in their lives and make the financial situation be worse than it was when they started. So how do you help people sort of decide, you know, whether they should follow their ambitions and keep expanding and growing, or maybe stick to a focus and be more of a clinician?
I think some dentists go into dentistry to get out of dentistry one way or another. More and more you see that, and people want to manage. They want to take their hands out of people's mouth and begin to look at the business aspect of it. So the first thing you got to do, though, is you got to get that practice, number one. That thing's got to run efficiently, because at the end of the day, you want to have practices run and you not be there, right? So in order to do that, you need to have the efficiencies of the practice set up where you can make a little bit of money off it after paying the associate that's there. Because if you need to be there to make money, well, then having multiple practices and having other people do the job, you're going to lose money in the whole thing. So first you look at the efficiency of the practice, because if you can get that practice to an efficiency, a general practice, let's talk about, and it's netting 40, 45%, and most associates nowadays are getting 35% of collections, so what does that tell you? I'm going to pay 35% of collections. I'm going to net 10%. Find me another investment that gives you 10% a year. It's tough to find,
yeah.
Right? So once you can do that and build that model and then duplicate it again and again and again, well, now I'm netting 10 to 15 to 20% off every practice I've got. Now you can leverage that model over and over again. But it's not for everyone.
Yeah.
And a lot of people think it might be.
Yeah.
I want 10 practices.
It's attractive. I mean, who wouldn't? It's attractive to anybody who wants to grow and make more money and be successful.
Right. But again, going back to in school, you never learn this in school, right? I do have some dentists that went back to school to get their master's in business because they wanted to focus, which was smart. You know, you want to be a CEO. That's what these guys did probably.
Yeah.
So to understand how a business runs. And once you get to five, six practices, it takes a whole new ballgame. I mean, now we're talking group practices, we're talking DSOs and management agreements, and it takes on a whole new look than your one doctor with two, three practices with a location or two.
Yeah. Do you find that more people are coming to your firm and talking about wanting to grow and turning into a multi-location group practice? Is that more common now than it was 10 years ago?
Definitely. My partner in Moore, Maria, she comes from a large group practice. She did mergers and acquisitions for them. So she brings in a knowledge of group practices that we never saw much in the past. And now I was just at a seminar in Austin, and you know, there are people with 15, 20, 30 practices getting gobbled up by private equity companies and looking at multiples and valuations and all kinds of stuff that we never saw years ago. So in the last 5-6 years, It's definitely, you know, and anyone will tell you that the corporate world's come into the dental world much more.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about how you see the industry and the landscape changing maybe over the next 10 years, because I think it's a lot of people worry, you know, will I be able to have my own practice and still be able to do things the way I want and come into work when I want, serve my patients the way I want? It seems like there's a big fear or sort of overarching fear that won't be the case, and eventually that I won't be able to do this unless I join a large group or I think at least it's important for our firm. We try to like make sure that on the show, especially as we have listeners call in and we get a lot of feedback in Q&A, there's always two sides to this coin, right? And it's not, corporate dentistry is not evil, and running your own single locations, not a bad life either.
Right.
So what's kind of some of, how do you see the landscape changing over the next 10 years? Where's the place for a really great single location practice, and where's the place for dentists who might be a better fit for corporate dentistry?
Yeah, I mean, I'm always amazed a little bit. I always ask the first question. Doctor says to me, I want 5 locations, I want 10 locations. What's your goal? What do you want? You want $1 million? I'll find you one practice that can make you $1 million.
Yeah.
So what is it that you want? You want the drive to have something bigger, you know? And if that's it and you want to be able to turn it and flip it, okay. So, I mean, I think the landscape it's changing. It's in the midst of full out change right now. There's no doubt. A lot of corporate is coming in here. Not as much in the Northeast as out West. Out West, mm-hmm. it's really taken a stronghold on a lot of things. But I think it will peak out at some point, because there are a lot of doctors out there who have an idea of what corporate dentistry means in a bad sense. And so they don't want to sell their practice to a corporate. Look at, like, you know, selling out type thing. They want it to be more of a family practice. So it will stop. I mean, at one point, you know, corporate dentistry was probably, you know, 10% of the market. And I think it's more like 40% of the market now. And in my opinion, I think it will maybe stay around 50, maybe even 60.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of the solo doctor will stick around for a while. Those new guys coming out, they may work at a corporate, but they're using that as a stepping stone, really.
Yeah.
Get their student debt down a little bit. The freedom and control. And I have practices that have gone the corporate route, and what happens after 2 years? They lose control. They're supposed to have clinical control, and I know there have been issues where they've lost that a little bit, and they're settling, figuring that out, but they lose control, vacation time, whatever it may be, whatever you can define control as, and they don't like that. And so, you know, that word's getting out there too. So those entrepreneurs, they want to be entrepreneurs because they want the control.
Yeah, they want the control over their schedule, their lifestyle, time, the way they do
their pay, yeah.
Who they hire, their team that they build around them. Yeah, it seems it'll be interesting to see how the landscape can change, because right now it kind of seems like there's been at least we get calls coming in quite a bit of, what would the multiple of collections be if I could sell my practice through a private equity firm?
Right. And question all the time. Great question. Like, yeah.
Wow. There's some momentum right now. It reminds me a little bit of like 1999. It reminds me a little bit of 2007, 2008, when like my friends all owned 4 rental properties.
Right.
You know, there's moments in economic cycles where something's really an attractive investment for some reason, and it causes a lot of people to flock in that direction. So we'll have to see how maybe the pendulum will swing back as people want more maybe control, or they want more time, or they want more autonomy, you know, and corporate dentistry will probably have to adjust slightly too to make that a reality. Because it seems like there's some great efficiencies that people can gain by getting intellectual capital, getting collaboration.
Reduce pricing. I mean,
there's a lot of efficiencies. But then if it changes your life and it makes a job that you once loved be something that you're not looking forward to, a lot of people are not going to want to do that.
You know? You turn from what was a lifelong career, loved going to work, to now a quote job.
Yeah.
And you're going in there, that changes things. I mean, and the problem with the multiple number is they get thrown out there, you know, 3, 5, 18. I've seen and read stuff about the practice of transition for an 18 times multiple. And like everyone, I want an 18 multiple.
Yeah.
That's really hard. Either certain circumstances that
it's very
get you
circumstantial,
there.
Yeah.
But what happens? These, you know, you got private equity in, and you've got, let's say, 10 practices, and private equity buys you out. Fine. What happens then? A bigger fish buys that private equity. All right. So you maybe just lost a tiny bit of control. And then what happens again? Another big fish. So now you're 3 sales in. You've cashed out. You've made a lot of money. But if you're still there, you got no control. You've got someone with 400 practices, and you're a number on the radar there, and that's about it. So there's money to be made, but you got to be very careful on how you do it, and the multiples can change left and right just depending on the marketplace. You can't live and die by those.
And it'll be interesting to see how the patient experience changes too along the way, because, I mean, at the end of the day, there's these customers. They're the dental patients.
Sure.
And in this business of dentistry,
can't forget about them, right?
As soon as they're forgotten, it'll be interesting to see, you know, how can a larger group service the needs of patients in a way that gets high satisfaction scores and that makes people feel like they love their doctor, you know? And so it'll be interesting to see how that evolves. Let's talk a little bit about if I'm trying to prepare to sell my practice, I'm thinking about exiting. I'm a single location to multi-location doctor, and I'm thinking about exiting. What are some of the things that I need to do to prepare in order to make that transition be smooth?
You know, the one thing in there I'm happy you didn't say was I'm a year out from retiring. And the good thing about that is because you really got to think about this about 7 years out before retiring.
No question.
And that's the first thing where people fall short, right? When do you begin starting about retirement and savings? You know, we talked about that earlier. You want to start in your teens, right? You start putting away a little money. So I'm starting to put money away 60 years before I retire. How come before I retire out of my practice, people are like, you know what? I'm going to retire in a year or two. I'm going to cut back and then retire. Bad move, right?
Totally.
We want to sell at that peak. So if we're 7 years out and you work hard for two or three and you know that every broker out there is looking 3 to 5 years back to value your practice, you want to go hard, right? You're an NFL player and you're going for a contract year. You play better that year, right?
Yeah.
So build that practice up for a couple of years. Look at the things that as if you were a buyer. You know what? Let's fix the carpet. Let's change the walls. Let's make it a little nicer for a couple of years. Drive that new patient count up, and then let's put a value to it and do it. So, you know, doing that early on will help. And the earlier you can get that valuation done, let's value it now and then make some changes and then take a look at it again. And so when it does go to market, it can market really well, show well, and, you know, you haven't left anything on the table.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about what you would recommend a dentist can do to make his relationship with his accountant more valuable, right? Because a lot of people, I think, might approach the relationship with their CPA or any professional advisor and kind of say, you know, that's what I'm paying you for. Like, you got to make this work for me. What's the responsibility that doctors have to improve that relationship as well? I know that you guys do a lot to bend over backwards to make it work for all your customers, but how can you kind of, what can you tell people that they can do, you know, that can help that relationship improve?
I think years and years ago it was, when do you talk to your accountant? On April 15th, right? I talk to him once a year. You know, the way we've developed our practice is it's all on a monthly relationship, a monthly retainer, and all on a fixed fee. Why? Because I want the communication. I want to talk to you more. I want the emails. I mean, nowadays with emails, it's easy, right? Give me your questions. Let's head down the same path at the same time. Not, oh, by the way, 8 months ago, I did X. And I'm thinking, well, I would have done Y, but let's now deal with X because that's the route you went. So I would highly encourage people to speak with their accountant on a regular basis. That is really your best business advisor. Why? Because it all boils back to taxes. It all boils back to the strategy that will lead to taxes and using them as a business advisor. So, you know, penny wise, pound foolish is a big comment I'll always say. Why? Because people, those that are afraid to spend money for good advice are going the wrong way, right? Yeah. You're going to spend $1,000, although you may think that $1,000 a lot, but I or a CPA can save you tens of thousands down the road or even immediately. I think that's probably worth it.
Yeah.
You know, so people try to do it on their own, and I'm sure many are very successful, and that's fine. But using them as a real business partner in the whole thing and not just your accountant, I think is very important.
Yeah, that's good. That's great insight. Talk to me a little bit about some clients of CPAs will say, you're not aggressive enough for me, or why don't you cut my taxes a little bit more? Tell me a little bit about your interactions that you've had with the IRS, you know, because I know that you guys have been through audits, you know, and you have lots of clients who probably pass through this on a, you have at least a few clients that pass through this on an annual basis,
sure.
You know, and so what does it mean to be aggressive, you know, the right way? And what does it mean, you know, how would you kind of respond to somebody who's talking that way?
Yeah, so, I mean, at the end of the day, the taxes and the tax return are the responsibility of the taxpayer. But I've got responsibilities and ethical standards to hit too. So the way I look at it, there's the black and there's the white. We're going to function somewhere in the gray where we're not breaking any rules by any chance. We're taking advantage when we can, but I'm comfortable signing a tax return and you're comfortable signing a tax return. Because what's going to happen if you get an audit? You're not going to sit in front of the IRS. I am. And I'm going to be able to, I need to be able to justify every deduction on there that I let go through the tax return, that I let go through my hands and say, I agree. This can happen because of X, Y, and Z. So if you're going to be a pig about it, you're going to get slaughtered pretty much because the IRS will see right through it. And, you know, but the other, you know, you want to make sure that we're taking full advantage of the rules. You know, you're allowed to have an automobile deduction. You know, you're allowed to have kids on the payroll if it's done properly. You know, so to make sure all the strategies are being done properly, you know, that's the key to success. We've been to court, we've been to appeals with the IRS and help clients out. Audits are random, right? And so whatever letters they get, you know, we'll handle the questions and whatnot, but we need to be able to stand up there and defend whatever deduction that we allowed, as long as the proper information was provided to us and we can go through and make sure that, you know, the aggressiveness, if you will, you know, is to a certain level that everyone's comfortable with.
Within your firm, do you guys kind of have a policy that you can kind of agree on to say, look, this is the position we take on this type of deduction that you guys talk about on a regular basis? And does everyone agree to on the position? How does that discussion work internally among partners?
No, we have those conversations. For example, we had a client just this past year. The person went to dental school, became an undergrad dentist, if you will, took a year or two off, and then went back to go to perio school. So once they started perio school, they were already a licensed dentist, and now they're paying tuition. At that point, tuition of $50,000 a year, it's deductible, okay? And so why is it deductible? Because it's really continuing education. You're not getting a new profession. I'm still a dentist. And so we had all the right facts lined up. Had to go all the way to the IRS, speak with them, no change, because we had the facts lined up. So we had all agreed as a team that deduction was okay, and we solidified that position once we happened to go through the IRS and get it. Yeah. And we had enough backup from other people to do it. So there are definitely things that we come across that a dentist may want to do, or that we may read somewhere, that we talk about together amongst our partners and amongst my peers to make sure that, hey, have you seen this before?
Yeah, that's great insight. Let's kind of wrap up with just a few parting thoughts you might have. Just any pieces of advice that you'd give a dentist throughout their, you know, at different stages of their career?
I'd say the number one advice is team. You get that right team in place. You get a good financial planner, you get a good accountant that understand your industry. Get a good bank person, get a good lawyer, and everything else will work itself out. They've gone through it before. They've seen the different ups and downs of both the industry itself and the different aspects that will affect your practice going forward. So getting people that specialize in the industry, I think, is valuable, and starting early. Like we said, all the process, whether it's financial planning, retirement planning, or getting your practice valued and looked at early on. I'd say start early and get a good team.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time today. We tried to plow through a lot of stuff. It was a really power-packed interview. I think a lot of people are going to enjoy this and enjoy hearing your perspective. So really appreciate you taking the time.
Anytime, Reese. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, man. We'll talk to you soon.